Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 29, Stephanie Kofell. Stephanie Kofell is a colorist. I have to be honest, I know very little about what colorists do. There have not been a lot of interviews in the past that I've read with colorists. It's not like the Comics Journal or Amazing Heroes or any of the other big places that would interview people in the magazines or even in podcasts, interview a colorist. So it's one of those things that I really, because I'm not an artistic person, didn't quite understand. I'd heard terms like Dr. Martin's dyes. I'd seen on some original art pages where the artist would actually put the notations of what something should be colored. But really, it's kind of a mystery, especially now that it's all computer colorization in comics, that I don't quite grasp. Stephanie was someone who's been coming to the Minnesota comic conventions since about 2006, and she's always been a very interesting person to talk to. She's a fun person, and at the last convention we actually sat down and had a real conversation, because most of the time at the convention I'm very busy running around doing stuff, and it's a lot of hi, how are you, this, oh, it's great, hi. It's kind of like a family reunion with too many cousins. But I found out that she did coloring for Archie and some stuff for DC and some stuff for early Vertigo, and that she was also heavily involved in the community where she lived. And then I friended her on Facebook and found out a lot more and thought she would be a good guest. We talk about comics, but we also talk about other parts of her life. And she's got a very good story, and I hope you enjoy the interview. I know that you worked in comics, but you also had to read comics. So were comics around all the time? Was it something you had to seek out? How were you drawn into them?
It's funny, the story, because I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and this is in the late 60s, early 70s, and girls didn't really read comic books, but my brother would bring some home, and I've never done this before, if you can't tell, and he would bring them home. He and my dad would go out to the little corner store and they'd bring some back. And I fell in love with them right away, the format, and just loved reading comic books. And I started copying, like drawing what I saw type of thing. And my dad's like, wow, you have some talent there. And I just kept drawing, you know, and I from a very young age, from the age of 5, I said, this is what I want to do for a living. I want to draw comic books. I wasn't thinking about coloring yet. I didn't think about how the colors got into the books. I just knew that I wanted to work in the comic book industry. And again, girls really didn't read comics, and much less, you know, did they work in the industry. It was like maybe 3% of the industry were female, and that included editors and that kind of thing. So as I got older, I wouldn't give up on this dream. And, you know, comic books were always around. My brother collected them. You know, he put them in the Mylar bags. He had the comic book boxes, the backing boards, the whole business. And I graduated high school when I was young. I was only 16. And growing up in, I actually had, I was a really good student, and my parents weren't too keen on the whole idea of me working in comics. So like, you know, you're a smart kid, you know, go become a doctor or a lawyer kind of thing. I'm like, nope, this is all I want to do. And growing up in New York, I had, I was very lucky because, you know, the big two at the time, Marvel and DC, were right there, you know, in the city. And I decided right after I graduated high school, and I'd been to Comic-Con, so people would see me, you know me, Carmen, I'm really short little redheads, and I'm short now, so you can imagine me at 16. I'm only 4'11", so I'm really tiny, and people would be like, oh, there goes that little redheaded girl that collects and reads comic books. So, you know, it's kind of rare, rare sight in the comic book world, and they'd have all these Comic-Cons like the Penta Hotel back in the day and that kind of thing over by Madison Square Garden. And so when I was 16 years old, I graduated high school, and I decided I was going up to Marvel Comics and asking for Stan Lee, and I did. And this takes guts, I guess. I you don't think of this now. When you're 16, you know, you own the world. You know, you don't think of anything being out of the ordinary or, something you just don't do. But I went up there, and I asked for Stan, and he came out. And I actually got a tour of the bullpen, the Marvel bullpen. And these people, I mean, these were like my idols when I was a kid. So these guys are just sitting around drawing, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. So, you know, Stan being the really cool guy that he is, he's like, you know, you're a nice girl. You need to go to college and have something to back you up in case this doesn't work out for you. And I said, no, this is all I want to do. And it took a few more years, but I ended up breaking into the industry through Archie Comics first and doing work for DC and Marvel as well, with coloring, actually, rather than the penciling or inking. So that's kind of the short version.
Well, so when you went up there, it was probably, what, early 70s? Early to mid-70s?
Probably. I graduated high school in 1983.
And Stan was still there.
Yes. He was there that day.
Because for the most part, I've always heard that in the 70s, he started spending more and more time out in L.A. just selling properties. He sold Spider-Man to like three different studios at one point.
Yes, maybe he was just there that day. But the people, the guys were still doing the bullpen thing at the time, because I remember people just sitting around at, you know, their tables sketching and drawing, and I thought, wow, I've never seen the actual process. You go to Comic-Con to see people sketching at tables, but,
yeah,
you know, the actual bullpen was like, wow. People didn't really do freelance then, or they were just on their way out to doing freelance. And so it was pretty impressive.
Now, you talked about how when you were 16, you were just going to go right up there and be part of it. Now, me, I lived outside a town of 250 people. To me, Stan Lee was like Robert Plant or Mick Jagger. These guys were like rock stars that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you heard about them very far away. And it sounds like you had a completely different, no, I'm just going to go there and they're going to give me a job.
Right, because I basically saw these guys at the Comic-Cons too. Like, you know, I'd go to Comic-Con and John Romita would be there, Bernie Wrightson. You know, I mean, these guys are just all over the place, and it just seemed like a normal, everyday, average, you know, thing. Just, you know, the offices are in New York. They walk around in New York. They go to the Comic-Cons there. They eat lunch in New York. It's like they're there, you know, and it wasn't, and I knew these guys were huge, but it just never occurred to my 16-year-old brain that you just don't do this. You just don't walk up somewhere and go, hey, can I have a job? You know? So
he tells you to go off and go to college. Your parents have told you to go to college.
My
what sort
parents,
of training did you get?
That's interesting, the story, because I said that was the short version. So my parents still weren't too keen on the whole comic book thing, and they knew this is all I wanted to do. And the only school I wanted to go to was in Dover, New Jersey, which was the Kubert School. And they decided at 16 I was too young to go off to school. And I thought, well, college, what, you know, what were you thinking for me? And they pretty much wanted me to go to, like, Brooklyn Tech or something, which was in Brooklyn. You know, you just take a bus there and home. And I'm like, that's not what I want to do. So eventually, you know, looking for something that was kind of recession-proof or had, like, that job safety net, I ended up, because I knew people, you know, in this neighborhood where I grew up, I knew the people locally that owned the pharmacy. And they said, why don't you come work for us and be a pharmacy tech? You know, why don't you learn the trade? And I went, medications and drugs and comic books. Let me think here a minute. There's no correlation, but it is a job. So I did that for a long time. I actually worked as a pharmacy tech for about 7 years. And I don't know if it was at the time you didn't need a license to be a tech. I really don't remember. This is going back some time and which is 30 years ago more. And I did that for some years and, you know, kept just trying to break into the industry and kept going to Comic-Cons. And eventually, my sister, who's a year and a half older than I am, she got an apartment in New York City on the Lower East Side, Alphabet City at the time, and she invited me over and a bunch of her friends to have an apartment warming. And, you know, in New York City, I don't know if you're aware, but the apartments are the size of a closet. But, you know, she invited like 100 people over, you know. Let's just all have an apartment warming. Okay. And I go to this thing, and it turns out that her roommate was a woman named Kathy Ziegler, who was dating a man named Victor Gorelick, who is the president of Archie Comics. And that's when she was like, oh, you know, I didn't even put that together. Let me kind of introduce you guys. And I met Victor that night. And she was like, Victor, this is my sister. She's been collecting comics, reading, drawing, all kinds of stuff since she was like 5 years old. You guys should talk. And that's how it happened. So it was right place, right time. That's exactly how it happened. And it was just one of those weird things. And Kathy and Victor, now they've been married over 30 years. And so it was a break is what it was. So
Archie Comics in the late 80s, at the time, they weren't doing much in the direct market, although they had, if I remember right, they'd picked up the license to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to do a comic based on the cartoon.
I don't even remember that. I remember my brother picking up this weird black and white comic and going, what is this? And putting it down.
Okay.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one. He didn't buy it. I remember that.
I did. And thankfully, it got me a car when I was done with college.
Wow.
So I still have all two, three. I have a number of copies of two and three and four. But number one, I got my one copy, sold it, and bought a $500 car.
That's amazing.
Yep.
Wow.
Back in the 80s, if you knew what you were doing, you could turn over comics pretty quickly for money.
Right.
Now you can sell them by the pound.
Wood pulp.
So when you came into Archie, there's a company that's been around since the 40s. And really, other than a couple of like blips on the radar, they've been publishing the same sort of story since about 1941.
Right.
And you're a new person walking in. So was it hard to kind of get into what they were doing, or was it, here, take a chair, and like the old 40s stories Will Eisner told about, okay, they just give you a chair and you're next on the assembly line. How was it walking into that office, and what was the sort of work that you did?
I started out with the coloring, but what I did mainly at the very beginning was recoloring all of the old digests. They were reproducing the same stories, like you said. You know, there was nothing really new in the works, and they just kept reprinting stories, but they wanted them recolored. So I started out with that. I believe to this day that I'm the only female colorist that worked for Archie. I'm pretty sure of that.
Wow.
And, you know, I had female editors. I had, like, Robbie O'Quinn was my first editor there. And there are other women, you know, obviously now they have, you know, women artists and such, but I don't think they've ever had another female colorist. But the atmosphere of the office, always very welcoming, really cool. It was odd because they had moved to Mamaroneck when I went up to the office. And it's kind of, the neighborhood is, how do I explain this? Kind of, it's not factories, but it has that feel. And
okay.
It's kind of very nondescript, the building, you know? But I'm like, okay, 325 Fayette Avenue, I'm at the right place. And then you open the doors, and it's like the Wizard of Oz, and we went from black and white to color. It's just like that. So it was very cool. Like, I'm in the right place, you know? And always very welcoming. Everyone was always very helpful and personable, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I was like, I'll color these things as long as you keep reprinting them. You know, I'll just keep doing it. And we did it by hand back then with, like, paintbrushes and paint, you know, and paper. They actually sent paper, and I would actually have to go out and get everything copied onto paper that was like Strathmore, something that was more porous that would hold the color better. And we were marking codes by hand. I mean, this is back in the day when, you know, nothing was really digitally colored yet. So, but I loved it. I loved, you know, I really enjoyed it. And then they came up with some new idea with Paul Castiglia called Archie's Weird Mysteries, and that actually ended up being colors for those, all of them. As well, and they turned that into a cartoon in Canada with PAX TV. And the colors that I lay down in the comic books is what made it into the cartoons as well. Because nothing had ever been colored like that before. You know, in Archie Comics, it was okay to have yellow and pink backgrounds or yellow and pink skies. And then suddenly there's, you know, it looked different. You know, the artwork was quite different, and the stories were supposed to be a little bit darker and kind of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer type of stuff. And so I colored them more realistically, like a Pop's chocolate shop would always have like pink and green Formica tables and pink and green stools. And here I had like, you know, wood grain in the tables. Like I made the tables brown, you know, and the colors were way more realistic. And at first they were like, wow, it looks so different and it's dark. And I was like, the stories are darker. You know, it should look different. But I had a great time doing that. And that, I don't even remember how long that went. There's actually Paul Castiglia is doing, I think today, as a matter of fact, he's in New Jersey at, I believe it's called the, I forgot what we called it, a weird and silly or some kind of Comic-Con they do in like East Orange, New Jersey. And he does appearances there with the Weird Mysteries crew. I think Fernando Ruiz actually goes to those as well. But I'm in Minnesota now, so I'm not there.
I was going to ask a little about the convention scene, because I met you, of course, at the Minnesota convention.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the first, because you'd gone to conventions as a fan, what was the first convention you went to as a professional, and how did it feel kind of jumping that barrier?
I went from being a fan to going to the San Diego Comic-Con, because if you're going to go big.
Okay. And for timing, what year did you go to San Diego? Because San Diego seems to have eras.
Yeah. San Diego Comic-Con, my first one was 1991, I believe.
It was still comic-based. It hadn't been completely invaded by media yet.
Correct. But it was a Comic-Con. Mm-hmm.
But this was also when, like, X-Men number one sold 9 million copies.
Yeah.
So I imagine going there was just almost overwhelming in some ways.
It was overwhelming in many ways. I actually saw it change because I'm thinking about it now. I know I went in 91, 92, and 93. And just in that short time frame, you could see how things, I mean, sure, they always had, you know, there's like Susie Owens, I met the Playboy Bunny, is on the other end of the Comic-Con, you know, and then you have baseball cards. And so there were always little pockets of things, but you saw it slowly turning away from comics, and I thought, it's a Comic-Con. And the number of people that would show up in the long lines and the, you know, they had Clive Barker shows up there to do a speaking engagement. And William Shatner was there in 1992. And he was there to talk about tech war. Tech world,
he
was writing, right.
Over at Marvel.
Right. And he was there. And it was funny because Fabian over at Marvel Comics, he was the editor on that. And I knew Fabian because DC and Marvel, we always played softball in Central Park against one another. And we were actually at San Diego Comic-Con, and, you know, Fabian comes up before William Shatner comes out, and he's like, listen, you know, when he gets up here, I know we're at a Comic-Con. And this was what struck me. I know we're at a Comic-Con, but we're not going to talk about actual comics. You know, we're not going to talk about Star Trek, I'm sorry, is what he said. We're not going to talk about Star Trek. We're not going to talk about other comics. We're not going to talk about anything like that. We're just here to talk about the Tech War, Tech World books, and that's it. And I'm like, oh, you know, we're at a Comic-Con. It just struck me as odd that he's there to, you know, to push this book. And it was I believe it was a graphic novel is what he was pushing at the time. And it just seemed odd to me. I'm like, we're at a Comic-Con. So someone stood up in the back right away and asked him a question about Rescue 911. It was awesome. Yeah, and it's like, T.J. Hooker. Oh, never mind. So.
I'm one of those guys, if I ever met Shatner, I'd ask him about the movie Mysteries of the Gods.
Oh.
It was the sequel to Chariots of the Gods, and he was the narrator.
Wow.
Where he's talking about the von Daniken ancient astronaut stuff. And if I remember right, this was when in his autobiography he said he was actually living in his vehicle. And
what?
I would ask, what? I want to know if von Daniken was just as whacked out as everybody says he was.
Now, I'm
just
curious.
Just all these little things that he was involved in.
And did he always use, like, the, like, Captain Kirk voice and stuff? Or, you know, I'm curious as to what that sounded like.
Well, it's available out there. He wasn't doing full Kirk. But he did have the pauses, the dramatic pauses, and very actorly. And the line we always loved when my friends and I get together and watch it, because we have bad movie nights, is when you see these pictures, you need to understand that the people who study UFOs say that these pictures are genuine.
Don't show them a picture of a Yeti.
Of course they will.
That's hilarious. That's really funny.
As you're there as a guest, my first question would be, did anyone come up and ask you for sketches or anything like that? And then the second question would be, everything I've heard about San Diego and Chicago, those were the two big ones in the 80s and very early 90s, was people went there to put the deals together, to do networking. It was always after one of those two that you would hear that somebody from Marvel had gone to DC and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So first, did you get a lot of people coming up to your table, or were you just kind of sitting there, you know, talking to the people next to you?
Yeah, I was one of those people. I mean, we had times that we had to be at the table because they had, you know, an agenda, you know, at the front of the table that so-and-so will be here from 1 to 3, so-and-so will be here from 3 to 5, that kind of thing. So I did a lot of the, and I wasn't there for the networking thing so much as I wanted to meet, you know, my idols when I was a kid. So, you know, I would walk around and be like, oh my gosh, you know, this person is here or this person, so I've got to go see them, you know. So I did a lot of that. And I wasn't networking, looking for work. I loved working for Archie. I wasn't thinking about working for anyone else. So I met Monty Hall, you know, like Monty Hall.
Wow.
So that was cool. And that made me sad because his line was like non-existent. And then you have like, you know, the Image Comics guys, you couldn't get near them. And I'm like, wow, Monty Hall is here, people, you know, that kind of, that just kind of struck me as odd. Like Mr. T was there the 1 year and I'm like, okay, he's bigger, even bigger. Most people, they say, oh, they look different on TV, or they look shorter. They look, Mr. T's like a living refrigerator. I mean, the man's just, I'm small, like I said, but he's ridiculously large. I was like, wow, okay. So it was, you know, people would come up and they would ask me for sketches, and I'm like, I don't sketch, I color. And I realized, wait a minute, I should probably be bringing either markers with me to these things or the actual paints so people can see the process. I started doing that. I started bringing the paints with me, as many as I could.
Okay.
Paint brushes and all, and I'd paint right at the Comic-Con on the pages, and I would either, and it's funny because I would make copies, like I said, on really, you know, good, on better paintbrush, I should say, than what they sent me, and I would give them to kids because kids would just be in awe. They'd be watching this like, wow, that's how it's done. Again, this is before computers, and I would hand them pages, you know, blank pages of what I was coloring, the black and white art. I'd be like, you know, take these home with you. Try this. You know, someday you might do what I'm doing. You know, no one told me, hey, you can make money if you color within the lines. They just told us when we were kids, color inside the lines, kids, you know. And
yeah.
I think I spent a lot more time being a fan than a guest. I know that probably sounds odd, but I was just such a huge fan for so many years that I would go to other people's tables. So I met all the Image guys, you know, and then there are the, before the San Diego Comic-Con started, there were dinners and parties, and then there's the after parties, and so there's a lot of schmoozing going on at those things for sure. A lot of people meeting people and putting together those deals, like you said. So
you worked in coloring before all the computer stuff came in.
Yes.
And to me, I can't tell you how many interviews I've read and podcasts I've listened to, but there's very little talk about what a colorist actually does. So why don't you talk a little about the tools you used and then what sort of innovations you did? You talked a little about with Archie's Weird Mysteries, you used different colors. And I've also heard Neil Adams talk about how when he was at DC, he got them to use a new color because he'd used it at Marvel and DC never used it. So when you came in, what were the tools of the trade?
We basically, like I said, we're working with paintbrush and paint. I use the Doc Martens, like the synchromatic colors, and these are actually very concentrated. So you have to actually mix, and with Archie, it was a little bit easier because they did use such simple palettes back then, even with the digest. You know, you knew that Betty's hair was yellow, Veronica had that blue highlight, Archie's hair is that orange. So the colors that you're using constantly, you have to mix them yourself. You'd have to know how much of this color and this color, kind of like when you're a kid and they said, you know, blue and yellow makes green, kids, but you had to know how much of each paint dropper, you know, because they have droppers in the caps, how much of this you have to mix with water to get this exact color. And we were working with in 10% increments only back in the day. It wasn't even 5% or 1%. So what we did was we worked in cyan, magenta, yellow, and K tone being the blacks or the grays. And basically, everything was in 10% increments. So Betty's hair in Archie Comics is Y, just straight Y, yellow. If there's no number, it's 100% of that color. Veronica's hair has that blue, same as Reggie, same as Jughead, just straight B. So you put a B as a code next to that. This is after you've colored the entire page, you have to code every single color you lay down. All of the flesh tones were called Y2, R2. That's 20% yellow, 20% red. Archie's hair would be YR2. That Y has no number. It's 100% yellow, 20% red. So you're telling the people who are doing the separations, because now your painted pages are being sent to someone to do the actual separations. This is back like in the days of almost like screen printing, where you have to lay down different screens to like print a T-shirt for every single color. So they have to separate those colors. So like the grass, you put down like Y2V2, 20% yellow, 20% blue. So you'd have to know off the top of your head. I could look at a comic book today and tell you what percentage is in that fuchsia or what percentage is in that brown. You know, I can tell you that because I've done it for so long. So being colorblind probably won't work for anyone who wants to get into this industry. But so they, you know, you had to know color and you had to be able to mix the colors. And I basically had these little glass jars. I would say I probably had, I'm trying to think now, probably had 80 colors pre-mixed at all times that I carried around in this wooden crate, because I used them constantly over and over again. You know, the chocolate shop again, they, you know, those pinks and those greens that were in the tables and the stools and everything, those were constantly used. So I knew the colors off the top of my head. And then once you went digital, you can do anything. You went from being able to use only 10% increments to 5s and 1s, and it changed everything. But it took a lot of getting used to, because for me, and you know, I know art is subjective for anyone, but for me, if I'm not holding a paintbrush to paper or to canvas, I'm not making art. You know, sitting at a computer with a lasso tool or a digital pen and a Photoshop or paint or anything like that, it didn't feel like I was creating anymore. It felt like I was just dropping in colors. Even if I was doing gradation and doing some kind of special effects, it didn't feel like art anymore to me. So I stayed with the paints as long as I could. And I actually did that by hand up until, I'm going to say, 2010. They still allowed me to continue hand coloring through 2010. I mean, computers were now being used everywhere, and I could do it because I used to assist my ex-husband. He's also still a colorist, Dan Vazo. And he, you know, did all the stuff for Vertigo. When Vertigo actually came into being, Vertigo didn't exist when we started working for DC in 1986, it was. Because I remember it was the year the Mets won the World Series. But anyway, New Yorkers, never happened. It's never going to happen. Oh, okay. But, you know, they had, DC actually, they didn't have, you know, the Marvel had like their bullpen. DC didn't have, you know, they had in-house coloring. But once they decided to go digital, they actually opened offices out in Flushing, Queens by Shea Stadium. And they bought these computers and pretty much sent everybody out there and said, figure these out. Learn how to do the coloring on computers now. So that was as early as 86. So they've been around quite a long time. It's just never, ever felt like me to creating. So I guess I'm old school. So.
Okay. Now, you started at Archie, but at some point you did do some work at DC. Were you able – now, first off, at Archie, were you freelance or employee?
I was always freelance. I was never under contract.
Okay. So you were able to work over at DC. Were you working at both companies at the same time?
At one point I was, and that was in the early 90s, because at that point, I'm trying to think now, again, this is going back a little ways, I had gotten married to Dan Vazo. I used to be Stephanie Vazo, V-O-Z-Z-O. And I had been assisting him on all of his Vertigo titles for years. I was helping him with Sandman, Kid Eternity, Doom Patrol, Shade the Changing Man. I was actually doing all of the Shade stuff at that point. They didn't know that though. So, oops. You can actually see the difference in a lot of the Sandman coloring. If you look at A Game of You, that entire, I mean, they've been recolored now for the graphic novels, but if you can get your hands on The Game of You, I think it was like, sorry, issue number 33 of Sandman, you can see the difference in the coloring prior to and after, because he was, I mean, obviously one person hand painting at the time or doing computer coloring, having 4 monthly books, you'd have to literally color a comic book in a week. It was impossible.
Yeah.
He was under contract for 4 monthly books, and he's like, I can't handle all of this. So I was taking on a lot of his work. So that helped me to get out of that head of pink and green counters and yellow skies, and it helped me to get out of that too. So I was doing that for Danny. I was assisting him, and then they started a book called Scarlet the Vampire Hunter, at DC.
Yes.
And that was my book. They gave me my first book at DC. Again, I wasn't under contract. It was just freelance. And I really enjoyed it. I actually, Gray Morrow was doing some of that stuff. And it was an amazing difference when I was doing it at Archie. And again, I loved it. I painted everything by hand. I was never happy with how the colors, you know, I marked up my colors just like I did by hand for Archie, but the separations were absolutely terrible. They were awful. So I was never pleased with the way the Scarlet books actually looked once they were printed, ever. I was like, this is not what I laid down. This is not what I coded. This is not what I marked it. The book ended up getting canceled after about, I think it was a year and a half, but the stories were great. You know, it was kind of like that Buffy thing again before Buffy. And from there, I actually, because I continued working for Archie, I was completely, you know, I was steady work. I never stopped working for them. Then I took on Sonic the Hedgehog, and that was fun because, again, coloring was different. That always looked great in print, so I was very happy with those.
Sonic, to me, is an amazing book in that, you know, it came out when the video game was popular. The video game has not been popular for at least 12, 13 years.
Right.
Because my son is in the video game world. I play video games. I was actually playing a video game before we did this.
Yeah.
Sadly, it wasn't Sonic, though. But Sonic has been one of those, a new game comes out, it doesn't sell well, people complain about it. But over at Archie, it's their one comic that they're publishing through kind of their revamp they're doing right now. They're still publishing Sonic, and it's been going strong for years.
And that's through Sega, and Sega's in California. So my editor on that book was in California. I never met my editor. It was Justin Gabriel, I believe it was, and never met him. Talked to him on the phone a couple times a week, just never met him. And I was like, wow, this is really weird. And that was new for me, too, like having, working with people that you never met in person. Like, you'd go to San Diego, and they'd be in Chicago. Or you'd go to, like, the New York Comic Con at the Javits Center, and they'd be at San Diego. So you were constantly missing one another. You talked by phone. This was before the internet. So there was, like,
yeah,
no Facebook, and you couldn't see what they looked like or whatever. You have to wait for a lot of those who's who in the comic industry books to come out, and they'd be, like, black and white photos of everyone. You're like, oh, that's what they look like, you know?
Okay.
So, and, like, Archie actually ended up doing the New Look series, when people started flipping out about, I don't know how many years ago, where they put out the four-issue, like, the little mini-series, and each character had a storyline. And they thought,
yeah, they were doing
people,
that in the digest.
People thought they were changing the look of Archie forever. They're like, no, we're just doing this for these issues. So people were flipping out, and they got tons of press for it, you know, some negative, some positive, but people were like, oh, Archie's doing something different. This is interesting. Outside of Weird Mysteries, it really hadn't been anything until those New Look series. And I worked on, there were six different series. I think I did four of them. And one of them I did with Norm Breyfogle, and he was one of my heroes from Batman. So I was like, I get to work on one of his books. This is so cool. I've never met him. He's in Michigan, you know, and I was in New York, New Jersey. I had a house in Jersey at the time. Never met him. And I'm like, that's just so weird. So, you know, to work with people that you've never met. I'm like, And, yeah, I mean, I met a lot of my idols, like, when I was a kid and stuff. But then once I got working in the industry, I'm like, oh, this is interesting, you know, working with people that you looked up to at the time or never meeting them. It's just an interesting circle, so.
Now, over at DC, you know, working on those Vertigo books, that was a very different style, and the art was very complex. I keep thinking, you mentioned Doom Patrol, and I can't even imagine some of those issues where you're having to color stuff that's really never been seen ever, because Grant Morrison does that.
Mm-hmm.
Did that give you sort of a reputation for somebody who could do coloring of more complex art, or is it, well, she's a colorist, she gets her stuff done on time, and it doesn't look bad? Are there people who look at colorists and go, oh, wow, this person is like a rock star in the colorist world?
I think they do that more now than they did then, because the colorist and the letterer are like at the very bottom rungs, you know, on the totem pole of, you know, obviously you've got the writer, you know, and you've got the pencil and inker up there, you know. The colors and the letter have always been at the very bottom. And I know now people, I know that people can name a colorist that they, you know, whose work they enjoy. Back then it was kind of like, well, we don't know how the colors get in there. It's not something we're really thinking about, you know. So it just, it is what it is. It's what, you know, not, like, how does the picture get into the TV? you're not thinking about that. It's just there, you
right.
know? So I think that that was a lot of it. I just wanted to speak to something you just said, and my thought just left my brain about, I mean, I always met my deadlines, and as far as, oh, the complex like Grant Morrison, it's funny because there is a book that still to this day has never been published that I helped work on with Danny. It was supposed to be George Perez's Wonder Woman book, and George is, we're talking about hundreds of little people in every panel,
yes.
like when there's a full splash, I mean, detailed and... So you really have to get in there, you know, and this isn't on a computer on a big screen where I can blow this up and really get in there. These are little teeny tiny people on a page. So, you know, that helped me, you know, for choosing different colors and just making, you know, understanding when a character should pop and when they shouldn't and when it's okay to do something monochromatic. And a lot of Doom Patrol was like that as well. I mean, the you know, the Crazy Jane and Clip, I loved coloring that book. Shade the Changing Man, I got to do a lot of crazy stuff with his coat. Sandman, the storylines were always changing. You know, there's a very different feel from A Game of You to when Mark Hempel was doing the kindly ones. So,
yes.
And a lot of that stuff with Mark Hempel, that felt a lot like Kid Eternity to me. So, you know, I got to experience a lot of different, which I was very lucky. And again, DC doesn't even know this. Unless they hear this, they don't know to this day that I was doing this. So I got a lot of experience, hands-on experience, just working on those books in the background, getting different feels like that. So, and another thing was, and obviously in the digest, this never occurred, but with a lot of the Archie New Look series, they had a few scenes where, like, Archie, you know, is in a movie theater, they're out buying popcorn, and then they're inside the theater. And I did monochromatic, all grays, you know, and I did some special effects with, like, the lighting. What was on screen was in color, obviously. But when you're looking at Archie and the gang, and I always loved what they called them, the gang, haha, before in the day, it was okay to say that. They weren't wearing colors or anything. But they, you know, when we're looking at them eating their popcorn, they're supposed to be looking at the screen. They're not going to be lit. They're sitting in the dark theater. So the moment I sent that into Archie, they were like, I don't know about this. I'm like, they're sitting in a dark theater, you know? So oftentimes, you know, we would get a script as to, you know, if it's daytime or nighttime, if you didn't see, you know, if the sky wasn't inked and there wasn't a moon and stars and type of thing. But we would get a script with some of these things. Like Katie Keene always came with a script because, you know, here she's wearing a purple dress because kids were sending in their art, you know, with a little dress. And I want her to have like an orange top and a yellow skirt. So those always came with scripts. Otherwise, I was free to do what I wanted. And I'm like, they're in a movie theater. It's dark in there. This is how this should look. And they left it. They let it go to print that way. And it was the first time I'd ever done anything completely monochromatic that made it into print. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about you were recoloring the old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did they store the old stuff? I know at Marvel, they used to have, they had the original art, but they also had film from mm-hmm. when the books were originally published, which was why some of the stuff they did in the 60s and 70s looked really bad. The film had deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've digitized a lot of that stuff. At Archie, did they take care of their archives, or was it, there's the archives, just grab stuff?
I don't know who did what up there with any of that stuff. I know when I went up there, they did have a system of sorts, because they'd go up, I'd be like, listen, you know, I did something a year ago, I never got my original pages back, and they'd kind of go to this section where they knew it was. It wasn't like a messy environment. It was a busy one, and they had a lot of stuff there, but I don't know who did what as far as any of that went. I'm not sure how they – I know that when I think about, like, the old guard at Archie, as far as changes or, you know, saving things. I mean, I think back to, like, you know, you had, like, the Moonwalk lunchbox. Your parents didn't think to save that for you. eBay, what was that going, you know? It wasn't something you thought of saving or, you know, keeping in good condition. So I don't know who did that back then, or, you know, what their process was.
One of the things they're also doing now I find fascinating is they're doing archives of the very early Archie stuff.
I'm glad.
And I imagine that is being recolored as well. Is that something that you know about, you're a part of, or is it something you just look at and go, wow, that's cool?
I know about it. I'm not part of it. I actually haven't done any coloring for anyone in about, I would say, 4 years, maybe five. So And, you know, there have been up times and down times, but I know I was never under contract, but one time I did have, like, the Digest I would recolor. I was doing Katie Keene at the same time. I was doing Sonic. I was doing Red Mysteries. And then it would be, like, a lull where I was only doing Digest. And then the New Look series came out, and I was doing all of those again. So, there was, up times and down times, that kind of thing. So I'm not currently doing any coloring for anyone. And
okay. Yeah. Have you just tapped out, or I know that you live in Minnesota now.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a lot of comic book coloring opportunity here in the great Norwegian state.
I haven't found any yet. I mean, it's not like I've looked all that hard either. I mean, I do go to the SpringCon and FallCon there at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds, but I basically go just to, like I said earlier, just share like pages with kids and go, here, take this home, color this, you never know, and just look at what's out there, what's new. I've always been a fan. I was a fan first. So, love reading the comics, I'm hooked on Saga, hooked on it.
And, same here. I read all 24 issues in two days.
You binge read.
Yes. And I think that's going to be happening more and more and more as people get away from going every Wednesday to, okay, I'm just going to buy these trades. I hear they're good. Or, oh, this stuff is stacked up. I'm just going to read it.
Yeah. It's hard, though, to know. I mean, you kind of, you trust what the people in the industry, the people that you know or other fans or friends of you, you trust when they say, hey, you should read this. But oftentimes something gets missed. And then what happens, like with you, you read like 24 issues, you're like, whoa, how did I miss this, And there's so much to read. It's just there's so many things out there. And then you have a lot of the stuff, a lot of people just do their stuff online. And it's like, oh, online comics, great, something else to read. So it can become a little overwhelming. Like, what do I read? What do I pass up? What do I buy? What do I wait to come out in graphic novel form? It's like I hadn't read Lock and Key until it was in the graphic novels. And I was like, wow, how did I miss this, So, yeah.
And it's very different from when we were kids, where if you didn't get that book the month it came out, good luck.
You're out of luck.
You may have to mail away for it. You may have to pay through the nose for it. Might show up at a yard sale.
Right.
I can't tell you how much Kirby, 70s Kirby, I bought at yard sales.
Yeah, and that always struck me. It wasn't that I was unaware, because I know oftentimes, and I'm not speaking for all New Yorkers, but many of them feel that the middle of the U.S. is just the flyover country. No one actually lives here. And if it's not happening in New York or California, it's not happening. So I would think to myself, well, I was a kid and I was living in New York. I'm like, okay, I'm lucky enough to live in this place and be able to go to Comic Cons and go through these comic boxes to find back issues. What do kids do in other places? Are there Comic Cons there? Are there big ones? Are there any? So that did occur to me when I was a kid. I was like, what do people do if they miss an issue? Here I am. Oh, I missed an issue 3 months ago, but there it is, in a box. And another guy right down the same aisle has it in a box, And I'm like, what do other people do? So, yeah, it's probably a lot
them.
Of catching up. Yeah, you missed them. Right, exactly. Like you said, the yard sales or, were there like groups where you could trade in the Midwest? I just didn't know what other people did. I'm like, but I'd rather live in the Midwest than anywhere. So I love Minnesota. Never leaving.
Yeah, you have moved here. Now, what is it that made you pack your bags and pull the Green Acres thing? Because I believe you're in St. Cloud, correct?
Wake Park, which is right next to St. Cloud, yeah. And,
okay.
Yeah, I just needed a change, and no longer married. And had at the time, my daughter was 11, maybe 12. She's 21 now. Kind of hard to believe, but... just needed a change. Both my parents had passed away in 2003 and 2004. And, just wanted to go somewhere new, somewhere I'd never been. It was kind of almost like throwing a dart at a map and, just saying, let's go there. And it was close enough to the cities. I know I still have a hard time saying cities because I'm from a place where Manhattan is the city. It's singular.
Yeah.
So people like going to the city. What? There's two. So that took me a little time to get used to, but I moved here in 2005 and, happily married now, here I am, 10 years later, and very, very happy. I love it here, so I'll never leave.
Okay.
Yeah, it's awesome here.
Now, you've gone to all these big conventions, and then I don't remember what year it was you started coming to ours. Did we find you, or did you find us?
I found you. I was looking online, and it was 2006,
Okay.
And I got in touch with Dominic, and he was like, give me your information, I'll mail you out an invite, and I've been there every year since. So I've never done, actually, Free Comic Book Day until last year, and that's because my husband's a musician, and every time Free Comic Book Day would roll around, he'd have a show out of town. And I wanted to do one, it was the year before last, in Delano. I found a comic book shop in Delano the day he was playing, but they already had people booked for that comic shop. I was like, darn it. So, yeah, I was seeking out things, different things to do here in Minnesota. I actually found a Girl Scout group it wasn't Owatonna, maybe Otsego. They were looking for professional artists that would come and speak to girls to, you know, something to do with the kids. They get, like, their artist badges and stuff. So I would seek out different groups in the area and, you know, places to go, things to do. And I actually prefer the smaller, I'm making little quotation marks in the air, Comic-Cons to the bigger ones. Because, like you said earlier, the San Diego Comic-Con, it's not about comics anymore. It's just not enjoyable. It's just this mash of people. It's pop culture and movies and everything now. And I'm like, wow, you know, don't call it the Comic-Con if you're going to do that. So, and I have to say that the Fall Con and Spring Con are outside of the New York Comic-Cons. And this was from years ago when they were having the Jacob Javits. What were they calling this con? This is in the 80s and 90s. It had a different name. I don't know if it was called the New York Comic-Con then or the... Because the Penta Hotel became the Penn.
The one now is a new entity.
Yeah, the one
but
now
I don't
is.
Remember what... But yeah, I don't remember the 90s.
Yeah, back in the day when they had the Comic-Cons and the Penta and they changed the name to the Penn, they had Star Trek conventions there. I think it was at the same time because I remember meeting George Takei up there. That was 1993 because I was pregnant with my daughter.
Okay.
And that was funny because he was there with his mom. That's a funny story because I get to the front of the line. Oh, my gosh, I'm a huge Star Trek fan. 1966, love the show. You guys are like my idols outside of comic books. Star Trek is my next, my other big thing. And he's like, oh, I see you're quite pregnant there. I'm like, yeah. He says, is it a boy or a girl? I said, I don't know. He said, well, make sure you name it after my character. I said, okay, I'll do it. He goes, first name and last name. I said, okay. And I walked through and I went, wait a minute. I'm like, Sulu, what was Sulu's other name? I had to go back and he knew. And he's got this big grin on his face. He's like, Hikaru. I was like, thank you. So that, you know, it's funny. I didn't mind. It's like comics and Star Trek, I'm okay with that because I'm a huge Star Trek fan. But now the big ones are just too big with the movies and, like I said, pop culture and, oh, it's just too much. It's overwhelming. So I prefer the smaller Comic-Cons, and I have to say Fall Con, Spring Con, best ones I've been to. The way they treat the guests and the fans just as equals, and it's pretty amazing.
We try to do a good job of that. Mm-hmm. I actually ran it from, God, when was it, like 92 to 96 or 7. And I was kind of the... They said I was the president, but really I dealt with the dealers and I dealt with the chaos, and I was the one when the news cameras showed up. That's how I got the nickname of the best dressed man in comics. I was there straight from work with a tie and a vest, and Channel 9 was there with the cameras, and they were looking for someone to interview, and they pointed at me and said, interview him. He's the best dressed guy here. And the rest of the con, they teased me with that. So I decided, no, I'm taking that name.
That's really funny. I was wondering how that happened. Thank you for sharing.
So you're not in comics anymore. What do you miss and what don't you miss?
I would say, being in touch with the other artists, you know, even if just by phone, you know, like what are you working on lately? And, Just chatting with them and being part of that scene, you know, because it was a lot of fun. What do I not? Wow. I don't miss anything that I don't. I didn't mind the deadlines, you know, just like any other job. You have a deadline to meet, you meet it, you know. And, you know, I used to walk around with paint on my hands all the time. And people would ask me, well, what's up with your hands? I'm like, yeah, so. And I liked it. I was like, yeah, my hands are all colorful. It's very pretty. It was very hard to get some of that stuff off, some of those colors. But there's nothing that I would say that I disliked about it that I wouldn't go back to. Or, yeah, there was really, I know a lot of people do that whole, you know, women in comics thing. And, you know, we're mistreated or, you know, frowned upon. And I never got that. I've never been treated poorly. I was never treated like I was never treated differently because I was female, and I'm not one of those, you know, I'm going to be in your face about the fact that I'm a woman in comics, and I'm not like that. So I'm like, I'm just one of the guys, and I'm here to do my job, and I did it, met my deadlines, and was never harassed. I was never, there's nothing that I would say that I disliked about it or that I, you know, and I wouldn't go back to, so.
Okay. Well, you're in a completely different place now, and we're friends on Facebook, so most of the things you post are about either your husband's music activities or sort of the social change stuff that you're involved in. And mm-hmm. I find both of those fascinating, especially your husband does a lot of very small open mic sort of things. And as an observer, it seems very social, that there's this whole social subgroup around it. And could you talk a little about what that world is like? Because much like how comics have their own little world, and we have conventions and fans and groups and things like that, it seems like there's this thing about acoustic music and open mic nights that I know nothing about.
Yeah, what it is actually, my husband's name is Dave Kofell, and he's been playing music for a very long time. I can't think of the word I want to use here. I mean, he's been playing since he was like 7 years old, but professionally he's been in bands for over 30 years, probably 40. And he and his musical partner, Adam Hammer, started an open mic at the local Blend in St. Joe. It's actually at 19 West Minnesota Street. And they started about 5 years ago because someone, I believe it might have been the owner, Jeff Engholm, might have mentioned that, there was some requests for it, that kind of thing. And, you know, could they do this? Could they host it? They'd have to pick one night of the week to do this, you know, from this time to this time. And they would each switch off, you know, 1 week Dave would do it, the next week Adam would do it, and that kind of thing. They'd alternate. And the thing about this open mic is that it's been running for 5 years straight, every Tuesday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. There's 12 time slots. Everyone gets 15 minutes on stage. You can play music. You can do poetry, interpretive dance, whatever you'd like to do up there, you know, keep it family-friendly kind of thing. We've had, you know, some stand-up comedy. I've actually done some stand-up comedy there myself because I think I'm hilarious. And if there's an open slot, I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? It's like, oh, I'm just going to go for the jokes here, you know, the things that I think are funny, things that come to my mind. And the thing about this open mic is that it's been running continually for 5 years, never been, you know, canceled. It's never been with an open mic, because this is the most successful open mic in central Minnesota. You have to have people who are absolutely dedicated to being there Tuesday night from 7 to 10, no matter what. If there's a snowstorm, you're there. If there's, a game or another, or there's a concert down the street that you'd rather be at. No. Those people expect you to be there. You know, they're looking forward to it. And what has happened because of that is it has grown exponentially into this. It's become a big family now. Everyone, you know, people meet at this thing and they start bands. They will have met at the coffee shop or, you know, I really like your stuff. You know, would you like to come write some songs for me, or would you like to start a band? And it's happened quite a few times. So, you know, other bands have come out of it. And so from that, actually, from that open mic, my husband, Dave, and his partner, Adam, they started something else called the Weekend of Songs, because they were talking about how many songwriters come into the local Blend. And, you know, they come in there and they're singing their original music, and they're like, why don't we have a 3-day music festival just for songwriters, singer-songwriters? So they started that, I believe that was 3 or 4 years ago, and we have that in August, the third weekend in August every year, also at the local Blend. And it just become one big family. You know, people, everyone knows each other by name, and, you know, it's always busy in there. We're right across the street from the college. Get a lot of college kids come in there too, just to listen or do homework or have a cup of coffee and, you know, talk with their friends. But, you know, what we tell people is, you know, there are a lot of booths there and a lot of open tables, and it's like, you know, it looks like the place is full, but if you see someone sitting by themselves with a laptop or a school book or something, go sit with them. Introduce yourself to them. Go make friends. So we're very much about that whole social atmosphere at the open mic as well. And, It's become huge. You know, the local Blend has been voted, you know, best coffee shop in central Minnesota, I think for 3, maybe 4 years in a row now. The open mic has been voted the best as well, best under 21 venue. because, you know, any age in there, most often time, more often times than not, they have music. Monday nights have music, Tuesdays open mic, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they have music as well, and more often times than not, there's no cover. So it's really grown. I mean, the whole music scene here in central Minnesota, there are so many talented people here. It's incredible. So we've had a lot of people come through there. We've had a lot of big names come in there, you know, to play at open mic or that want to be part of Weekend of Songs. And it's been a lot of fun. It's huge, and I love music. So you should come out sometime.
And then you've also been involved. There's a couple things. There was a march, I remember, a few months ago.
Oh, yes. That was Justin Michaels running that, yeah.
Okay. Could you talk a little about that?
That was the We Are One March.
Yes.
St. Cloud to the courthouse. We met at the courthouse and decided to march over to SDSU. We have a very large Somali population here in St. Cloud. And there have been a number of instances where their mosque has had their windows broken. I think 3 times now they've actually had the windows broken, and they're fearful of going to a place where they're praying as a peaceful people. So, you know, we need to be not just more tolerant of other people, but meet with them, understand them. Obviously, a lot of people fear what they don't know or they don't understand. And my point to joining this, I mean, I'm from New York City. I was a minority where I'm from, so I know what it feels like to be treated differently. You know, my mom's Puerto Rican, my dad's Jewish, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood, and I lived in an area where Al Sharpton came marching down our street, 68th Street and 20th Avenue a few times, because over a 3-year period, 3 young black men were chased or beaten to death in my neighborhood for being in the wrong neighborhood. And I'm like, there's no such thing. That's ridiculous. You know, it makes me sad. I'm thinking about Martin Luther King, you know, we just had Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and I'm like, you know, we're 50 years on, and this is how far we haven't come, really. You know, just the fact that we're in this age and we're still discussing this is really disappointing to me. And I wonder, where does this come from? And I don't know if you've seen this. This just happened here in Minnesota a couple of days ago. This man he took a video of his daughter. He adopted a little girl, African-American. She's 12 years old now. And she was being bullied over a cell phone or Snapchat or something like this. And he outed the father of the kids who were doing the bullying because he was just poisonous, just toxic on the phone. Homophobic slurs, race slurs. I'm going, that's why it still exists. Because people are passing this on to their children. And that's just, it's just not acceptable. And so I became part of that. And so, you know, peaceful march. And it was wonderful because they actually had people there from the mosque speaking. They had different religious leaders there. They had people from the Catholic Church, Presbyterian, Lutheran, from the mosque. They had someone come there from a temple in town, and it was like, wow, just to show, you know, we can make this community whole, which is really, really important to me. Since then, I've actually decided to become a volunteer, start volunteering with Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota, you know, to help at-risk youth, kids who come from lower-income families who may not have the mentoring that they need, or be in a situation that's healthy for them. And, you know, I have people, you know, and I can be there for them, you know, to help them be creative in arts that they might not be exposed to outside of comic books, because I do love the arts as well. And Dave can help them with music, you know, and he can be there and teach them how to play music or about different types of music, because, you know, he may be playing folk and blues, but we also sit at home and listen to classical music. You know, we love all kinds of music. So expose the kids to things they wouldn't ordinarily be exposed to. And again, make the community whole. And, you know, gardening, things that they wouldn't be able to do ordinarily. There's a community garden here. Help teach them to grow their own food, you know, healthy foods and different ways of eating, you know, when you're on a budget because you're from a low-income family. You know, I grew up poor in Brooklyn, you know, and like I said, as a minority, and it was tough. So if I can give anything back to the community, I'm more than willing to tell me where you need the help, and I'm there. So that's important to me.
I think one of the things that going back to comic books, I've often thought that being exposed to comic books and science fiction and things like that helped me in the way that I don't fear, and I use Joseph Campbell's words, the other.
Hmm.
the people who are different from us, most people fear that. The person that you were talking about who was homophobic slurs and racist slurs and things like that, it's, well, these people are different from me, so they must be bad. Humans, in my mind, are very tribal.
Mm-hmm.
We have our families, we have our tribe, we have our group, we have what we're part of. But especially Marvel stuff in the 70s and the science fiction I read, it was very much about, no, they're not the other, they're us. Stan Lee was big on that. Marv Wolfman was big on that. Don McGregor could not have been a better person for me to read at that age, because his was all about humanizing not just the hero, and the hero might be African-American, or he might be this, or he might, but he would humanize the villain as well, so that you went, well, I disagree with him, but I see where he comes from.
Right.
And as long as we're not, as long as we're in a situation where we're dehumanizing people who are different from us, we're going to have those problems. And in a small town, I often tell this story, there would be at least one time every year where, you know, our little bitty school out in the middle of ultra-white central Illinois, someone would go, I hear a black family might be moving to the county.
Mm-hmm.
And they treated it as if aliens are invading.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always the one who went, oh, cool.
Right.
It never happened, but still, that would have been cool.
Right. And it's funny because Dave grew up in Collegeville, Minnesota. You know, he's the youngest of seven kids. Both his parents are educators. And it's like, I mean, they taught their children, we're human, you know, we're all the same. But I mean, this is a rare thing to think that then. But even still, he'd be walking in St. Cloud in the, you know, early 70s. And he said, if you saw a black person in town, it was like, what? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't help but look, because it was such, it just seemed so out of place. You know, it's like, what? You know, it just wasn't something you saw every day. So, of course, you turn and you look. He said, but, I mean, he comes from a very accepting family, amazing people. I understand, you know, coming from where I come from, I'm thinking, you know, I moved here. I'm going, okay, what year is this? Was my first thought. And, like, okay,
yes.
So let me take a step back and see why. And I understand the fear of the not knowing and not understanding. So, you know, by the same token, I'm thinking to myself, you know, a lot of your people, whether German or Norwegian, they came here, what, 100 years ago? They settled here? And it takes a couple of generations to assimilate, but it just seems like people are intolerant of allowing this group of people to assimilate. And I wasn't here when apparently there was the Hmong community was, like, large in St. Paul, or there was a large... And I wasn't here for that. And he said, you know what? The same thing happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. People will get over it. I'm like, okay, I understand that. But, and it's funny because just thinking about this now, like, you know, Promised Neighborhood, and I have a friend named Marnita Sherdell. She runs Marnita's Table. And I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but she's in St. Paul, and she calls it ISI, I-S-I, Intentional Social Interaction. What she does is hold these tables, and she does it at people's homes, at restaurants. She's had them at the YMCA, different, and she goes all over the country now. She does this. She started this, I would say 9 years ago, probably. And she invites people across race, across ethnicity, education, no barriers. I don't care if you're homeless. I don't care if you have a master's degree. You're invited to this dinner, free of charge. When you arrive at the dinner, usually, and she says, you know, bring someone along of a different color, of a different, you know, educational background. Bring someone along with you. When you arrive, you can't sit with that person. You have to go sit at a table where you don't know anyone.
Right.
And on the table are these cards, and they have questions on them. And they're, you know, completely random questions. But by the end of that dinner, you will find you have something in common with everyone at that table. And these are people you may not have invited to your own home for dinner because they're different, because they're Somali or black or they're homeless. Or, you know, you didn't graduate high school, but this person is a PhD. But you will have something in common with everyone at that table by the end of that dinner. And I love this. I love this model. I'm like, okay, this is what we need in St. Cloud, you know. And you can't force it. You can't rush it. But to help close that gap, to help understand where is your fear where does this come from? And maybe you were taught this by your parents and or your grandparents to me. And I'm like, so here I am all these years later, you know, having graduated high school in the early 80s going, wow, we really haven't come this far, have we? It's just sad to me. It's just sad.
I think it's in pockets.
Yeah.
Because I graduated early 80s as well. And while I can, if I turn on the TV and watch the news, which I don't do anymore, I don't watch any cable news. None of it, because it's not news. It doesn't inform. It's talk radio with pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about your life, I tend to, when people put on Facebook the stuff about age, well, when I was a kid, we didn't have the internet. When I was a kid, you know what? Just think about how cool it would have been for me or you to have the internet as a kid, to where you could connect with other comic book fans or you could connect with other people across your interests. I've been on the internet since the early 90s, and I know people all over the world because we have this common interest in stories with words and pictures. But then I get to hear about their lives and what it's like to be, what it's like to be a Sri Lankan immigrant in London, or what it's like to be someone in a Roma in southern Germany. And we all have the same sort of problems. We all, you know, we want to get something decent to eat. We all want to have a job. We all worry about our relationships. We have so much in common. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we communicate to one another, rather than turn on the TV and here's what horrible thing has happened and here's the politician who's going to yell at this group of people. But the more we talk to each other, the more we'll realize that we all have everything in common. We all have dreams. We all have fears. We all have something that broke our heart. We all have something that we still want. We all want, you know, we all want certain things, and there may be gradations of difference. But it all boils down to pretty much human beings want similar things.
Absolutely.
And I think the work that you're doing around that is pretty amazing. And I wanted to highlight that because one of the themes of this podcast is that we all have a story.
Yeah.
And I think you, growing up as you did, being kind of, I always call it the backstage people at comics, because you've got the stars, but then you have the people who do the work that you has a lot to do with it, but doesn't make it on stage as much.
Right.
And then you're here and involved in community, and maybe you've left comics behind. Maybe you'll go back. Maybe you won't. But you're building community in all these different areas, and I think that that's wonderful and fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's important, like what you said about, you know, I believe, and I've always believed this, even as a kid, you know, I was thinking, we're growing up in Brooklyn, New York, melting pot. I mean, everybody around you is from somewhere else, you know? And I just found it fascinating to meet these people, to understand where they came from, why they came here to the States, or, you know, learn. I love to cook, and I'm like, wow, look at all this different food, you know, that kind of thing. I was always astounded by how other people live, like their traditions and, you know, their different, so just their ways. And it always interested me. So I just thought, you know, wouldn't it be interesting now if I could somehow get involved in the community? And it was funny because coming to St. Cloud, I didn't think that this would be here, that this would exist. And I would just hear these, you know, these ugly things, or, you know, the windows are being broken at the mosque, and I'm going, wow, you know. And if we can show them a little love and help them to understand that not everyone in the community feels this way, you know. And so it's funny because my sister-in-law, Anne, Dave's sister, the lawyer, she was, I had posted something on Facebook again that I saw in Sweden. They were having the same problem there. Unbelievable, right? And in Sweden. And they're marching there. And this is not something normal for Sweden. I'm like, I didn't know that. But they were having this problem where people, you know, they burned down mosques is what happened. They didn't just break the windows, they burned it down. It was like, that's horrible. And someone came up with the idea, this one wall was still standing, they said, let's love bomb the mosque. I'm like, I was hoping for a different term than love bomb, but okay. And they cut out hearts from paper, and they wrote these, you know, these really nice sentiments on them, and they put them all over this wall. So I kind of posted this on Facebook. I was like, hey, check this out. Someone in St. Cloud ought to do this. This was early on a Saturday, no, on a Friday morning. And Dave and I were out and about somewhere. He may have had a show. By that night, his sister Erin had, you know, she saw that I posted this. She put together an event. We're doing this tomorrow. Be there or be square. I'm like, wait, what? That was quick. So we went the next day. So I spent, you know, the next morning cutting out red hearts and pink. And I went over there and we hung all these things up on their, you know, on their windows, on their doors. I'm like, I want them to feel the love that they're welcome out in our community. So I thought, you know, how many people might see this? So Ann and I are there. And then a couple of college kids came along. One was named Ben. I remember him vividly because he struck a conversation with me. And Ben brought a friend of his along. And then another person came along. And then a woman pulled up in a car with her two kids. They just had 11. And just everyone's coming with these horses. I'm like, how cool is this? You know, it's just to be able to do that, to be able to make a difference and spread the love and help people who may not feel welcome or may not feel like they're part of the community, understand that you are part of the community. It's going to take time, but we're going to get there, you know? So that's really important to me.
Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. And if somebody wants to get some of your work, they have to dig through the back issue bins and grab some of the older digests. But if you want somebody to see kind of you at your best, what do you think would be the best thing for people to look at?
I'm going to say Sonic number 100. You don't have to dig for it, but it's out there.
Okay.
I mean, I could say some of the Vertigo stuff. My name's not on there. I can tell you like which issues I did, but that won't work. So.
Okay. Well, thank you again. And I'm sure we'll talk again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And that's the interview. I learned a lot from this interview, especially the stuff about how coloring was done, that they still did it with actual paint and everything until, gosh, as late as the 2000s. Archie is going through this big revolution right now. In the latest previews, they've actually ended all the Archie regular comic books, and they will be coming back. Mark Waid and Fiona Staples from Saga will be doing a relaunch. To find out about the open mic night that Stephanie talks about, go to thelocalblend.net, and then you can just click on music and events. They've got a calendar, and then there's open mic night that she talked about. And if you are in the area, drop in. It's at 19 West Minnesota Street in St. Joseph, Minnesota. Let them know that we sent you. She's also there on Facebook at Stephanie Kofell. And I want to thank her again for coming on. Now, this episode has sponsors because you got to have sponsors. Sponsors pay the bills. And our sponsors are, as always, DreamHost.com, the best darn web host in the whole known universe. If you go to DreamHost.com, and put in the code CRAZY, you get $20 off your first year. Their rates have actually been going down over the last few years as what they give you keeps going up. So head on over to DreamHost.com. If you need a web page, they're the best ones. They're the ones I use. I also have been trying to be healthier, as I think every human being on the planet tries to be healthier. And one of the things I do for that is I get my snacks from Graze.com. Graze.com is healthy snacks delivered every week, every 2 weeks, every month. They have all sorts of options now. You can get larger snack packs that you can share with the people at your office or your family. They have ones that are focused on certain areas. Would you like savory snacks? Would you like sweet snacks? Would you like a variety? And you can get your first and fifth box free if you use the code CORYS3R5P. That's CORYS3R5P. Head on over, you get your first and your fifth box free. And I get amazing razors delivered from the Dollar Shave Club for just a few bucks. Now I always shave with a fresh blade. Does that make me a genius? Yes, it does. If you head on over there, use the webpage dollarshaveclub.com/crazy. And they'll kick a little back to this here podcast. Once again, I want to thank you for downloading. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for all the letters and the tweets and the retweets and the people talking about it on Facebook. remember that the thing you could do to really help this podcast, other than going to visit our sponsors, is to let people know about it. Let people know that you like the podcast. Let people know the podcast exists. Let me know what you'd like to hear, what more you'd like to hear. I'm starting to hear from people. They really want more Kirby. They want more EC. You'll be getting more Kirby. You'll be getting more EC. But I also like doing the interviews because I like bringing you stories of people that Joe and I wouldn't really... Joe and I don't do interviews. So I like doing the interviews, and hopefully I'm becoming a better interviewer. If you know of someone who you think it would be fun for me to interview, or if you're someone who would like to be interviewed, you could go ahead and email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. If you'd like to be an advertiser, you can also email me at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject advertising. And that's the same web address that you would use just to send me some feedback, just to tell me what you like, what you don't like, and what you'd like to hear more of. That's the end of the episode. We'll be back next time for more stories on Solitaire Rose Radio.